Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, I would love to hear from you. Send me an email. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. We are past 190,000 downloads of the podcast. Like, wow, 190,000. Thank you, and thank you. I could not have done that without your support and you sharing with friends and family. I hope those have been informative, that you've learned something, had some fun. So, again, thank you for your support. I just want to read a little bit. Today I'll be speaking with Robert Proctor, the author of Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. And this is from his chapter called Penetrating the Universities. There are many examples, but consider this testimony of Lynn R. Lamott, professor of statistics at Louisiana State University, testifying under oath in 1997 for the defense in Texas versus American Tobacco. Question, do you have an opinion as to whether or not cigarettes cause disease? Dr. Lamott says, I have an impression. I don't know. I wouldn't want to call it an opinion, but I have, you know, a general uninformed impression. If you want to call it an opinion, I need some basis in fact for it. But I have a general impression that what was the first question? Let me rephrase it, Dr. Lamott. Yes. Do cigarettes cause disease? Dr. Lamott says, okay, so the question is, do I have an opinion as to the truth of that statement? Is that correct? Question, however you want to answer it. Well, I have a general causal, uninformed lay impression that I think is probably a fairly general impression that smoking cigarettes may lead to some sort of health deficit. All right, people, you get the idea that the guy was totally dancing around answering the question, do cigarettes cause disease? Actually, this goes on for about 5 or 6 more interactions, and he barely answers the question, do cigarettes cause disease? And as a matter of fact, it gets to the point where the questioner is like, true or false? Okay, you give exams, so true or false, do cigarettes cause disease? And the professor says, I don't know. So this is how deep this goes. But I believe that the professor that I want to speak with is on the line today.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. How are you? Robert Proctor.
Hey, doing pretty good.
Thanks for calling in today.
Sure. No problem.
Let me just tell them a little bit about you, that you're a professor of history of science at Stanford University, and you're also the author of Cancer Wars, Racial Hygiene, and the Nazi War on Cancer. And also, you are a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Science. So welcome today.
Hey, happy to be here with you.
So this is an amazing book and lots of scholarly work. I mean, your eyeballs must be tired. Did you take a vacation after writing this book?
Yeah, though there's a lot more of this garbage to dig around, so I'm deep in that.
Oh, it's so much more. And the way that the book is organized could be used to research, say, items such as alcohol or makeup or all different types of areas that need to be researched and how we've been hoodwinked and bamboozled, so to speak, in those industries. But let me just start off with some quick facts from the CDC that smoking causes cancer, heart disease, stroke, and lung disease, including emphysema, bronchitis, and chronic airway obstruction. For every person who dies from smoking-related diseases, 20 more people suffer with at least one serious illness from smoking. And worldwide, tobacco causes more than 5 million deaths per year, and current trends show that tobacco will cause more than 8 million deaths by 2030, unless, of course, we ban them, like you suggest.
That's right. Yeah, you're talking about the world's leading cause of death. Basically, half of all smokers will die from their habit. And it causes weird things like, vascular degeneration resulting in amputations. And, of course, even causes environmental harms. We don't even think about that, but it's a cause of contributed to global warming. And, you know, basically for me, getting rid of cigarettes would be a win-win proposition.
I agree with you. I think win-win all around. As a matter of fact, the other day I was in the park relaxing, and I was just having a nice day with low humidity, just la la la, and like two or three seats down, somebody was smoking, but the smoke was trailing down to me, and I tweeted, couldn't we ban cigarette smoking in public parks? Like, please, cough, cough, you know, because, I mean,
really?
I wasn't raised, yeah, that, it was, I mean, if you check my tweet timeline, you'll see that. But let's start with the beginning of cigarettes and the creation of cigarettes. Explain to the audience about this idea of fluking that's discussed in your book.
Yeah, fluke curing. That's the, you know, cigarettes are not just tobacco rolled in paper. They have to be cured. And in the 19th century, a process called fluke curing was invented, which completely changed the chemistry of tobacco smoke. Prior to the 19th century, the sugar content of leaf was about 2%. It was very low. But fluke curing basically trapped the sugars in the leaf. And as a result, when you burn those high sugar leaves, you get a very neutral, mild smoke that for the first time in history could be inhaled. And this meant that, and actually had to be inhaled to achieve nicotine satisfaction. And so as a result, you get this mild, inhalable smoke, which ironically was even thought to be safer than other forms of
cigars,
but actually was far more deadly. And so I call that the fatal flaw of cigarette manufacturing.
Now, another issue that caused, I guess, I'm going toward like the mass production of cigarettes, is you talk about the development of matches and the portability of fire. And also you discuss the machinery to create cigarettes and how that really spurred this mass production. Talk to us a little bit about these machines and how they were coveted by these different, global tobacco corporations.
Yeah, these are actually the deadliest machines in the history of human civilization. Each one of these machines now, and they're only made by three factories in the world, and if you actually to close those factories, you do more for public health than anything in human history. And these things produce 20,000 cigarettes per minute. And that's why we have so many cigarettes being produced today, because these machines can produce them in such enormous volumes. So let me just give you one index of that. If we were to make all the cigarettes smoked in the U.S. today by the same techniques before these machines were invented, in other words, the hand-rolling women of
mm-hmm.
the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
it would require a labor force of 3 million people. In other words, we've got these behemoth machines spitting out cigarettes at, 60 or 100 miles per hour. And that's why we've now got worldwide 6 trillion cigarettes smoked every year. That's 350 million miles of cigarettes every year. And that's why it's such a global health catastrophe.
Now, this is interesting that basically, you discuss overall that these industries have a license to kill. And you bring up the issues of other areas where, if it was, I think, spinach or something you were talking about that had this, chemicals in it, that, the FDA would, no more spinach for anybody. But
yeah.
For some reason that, cigarettes continue. And one of the things I liked about this section is you bring up the people who are pro-smokers and how they felt like they were being marginalized by, everybody else, and they were a minority, all these types of things they tried to align themselves with. But what is so important is we think we make free choice, but we don't.
Yeah.
And I love your mass marketing section, from skywriting to toys for kids, chocolate. I remember smoking the candy cigarettes and thinking that was cool.
Yeah, can you believe that? I mean, basically the tobacco industry in the 1920s was trying to get women to smoke by saying, reach for a Lucky instead of a sweet. And so cigarettes will keep you thin. They're almost therapeutic, keep you from getting
mm-hmm.
fat. And as a result, the candy manufacturers got sort of irritated and they threatened to sue. And basically, in the end, the cigarette makers just said, okay, we'll actually make candy, or at least we'll allow candy to be made with exactly our brands. And so you had all of these Camel and Winston and Lucky Strike candy cigarettes. And the companies actually sent their artwork for the actual packs of cigarettes over to the candy companies so that these candy cigarettes would look exactly like real cigarettes. And they basically called it training in gestures, you know, and planting Philip Morris in the minds of future smokers. So there was a real
propaganda. I almost screamed when I read that. I was screaming because I'm a parent, and I was just like, oh, my God, this is crazy.
Can you imagine? You know, it's wild. It's wild.
Well, what about the book covers? They were sending book covers with smoking advertisement on the book covers to teenagers. Fortunately, some people had common sense and refused them, but you talk about that also. And also, oh, my God, what about in the arm, the amputee with the cigarette holder in the amputee arm?
Yeah, basically, there, you know, we live in this world not only of tobacco exceptionalism, where, you know, a drug that would normally be banned if it had one-tenth of its deadly value. I mean, we also live in this world where our whole physical environment has been made to accommodate cigarettes. So, you know, the male pocket of this, you know, or the ubiquitous ashtray, you know. And so it's like our built world. You know, that we've even got a computer museum here where the Armageddon machine for managing World War III has this built-in cigarette lighter, you know, and it's just unbelievable.
Well, another interesting thing, and, you know, I do a lot of shows about different health topics, but this idea of, let's talk about a little bit, what exactly is in the cigarette, and this fakeness of the light cigarette or the filter you talk about, and that those things really aren't going to protect you from the effects of nicotine or tar, because the key issue, I think, that you bring up in the book is the manipulation of these chemicals. So it may be low tar, low nicotine, but even a small amount, if manipulated properly, poof, you get
That's
like this massive high, it gets inhalated and attached to your lungs. Talk to the audience a little bit about this manipulation of the chemical itself and how even though it's small,
it's significant. Yeah, in fact, there's one document I found where they said that the industry had spent tens of billions of dollars on cigarette design since the 1940s. I mean, look, this is one of the most carefully and craftily engineered objects on the planet. You know, you've got 630 different additives have been used, ranging from exotics like Rose of Latakia to castoreum, which is a secretion from the anal gland of the Siberian beaver. And then they've got all kinds of things like ammonia that they put in to freebase the nicotine. They put in levulinic acid in order to increase the efficiency of the binding of the nicotine molecule in the brain. I mean, this is a real witch's brew. And then there's all the stuff in there by accident. And I'm not just talking about you know, worm excrement and bugs, which also gets in there, but also things like polonium-210, which is a radioactive isotope. And smokers don't realize this, but smokers are exposed. The main source of radioactive exposure for smokers is cigarettes from the radioactive polonium isotope that gets in there through the fertilizer. So it really is a witch's brew.
And you mentioned in the book that radioactive isotopes were identified in smoke as early as 1953. And we haven't even touched on the cancer. Let's talk about this issue of lung cancer. That as early as, I think at one point it was like 1890-something, that someone had hypothesized about that this idea of lung cancer. And then there was a doctor in Buenos Aires. Talk to me about that, doctor. I was looking for this name right now as you're...
Yeah, Dr. Raffo, you're talking about.
Dr. Raffo,
you know,
yes.
Yeah, the important background is there is lung cancer was an extremely rare disease. There were only 140 cases known worldwide, whereas now just in the U.S. we have 160,000 cases every year. So it was such a rare disease that if a doctor saw one, they would call in their associates and say, hey, look at this super rare disease. You may never see another one in your whole career. Of course, by the 1920s and 30s, with cigarettes, you know, being given to soldiers, and then massive increase in smoking, this becomes a really major cause of cancer. And then along comes Dr. Raffo, and he's one of the great unsung pioneers. He's almost completely forgotten in Argentina, and he started painting tobacco tars on the backs of mice and rabbits, and he showed that they could produce cancer, and he showed that there were carcinogens in smoke like benzpyrene and other polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So he's really one of the great pioneers, and he was basically ridiculed and then, you know, ignored.
Well, what the it's a whole web of manipulation. You know, they use advertisements. You talk about we talked about the marketing with kids and women, but also sports, in all types of radio, TV. You know, counting the number of spots on I Love Lucy, basically owned by one of the tobacco companies.
Yeah, Philip Morris.
But yeah, and now you know what's also interesting and. It was a sensitive issue. You know, let's talk about the title of your book, The Golden Holocaust, and how did you come up with that name? And you also explained that there are other books surrounding cigarettes and using the Holocaust. Talk to me about how you decided that.
Well, much of my whole career is based on exploring race. I'm from Texas. My grandfather was in the Ku Klux Klan. You know, I've been attuned to this. I was the first senior scholar in residence at the Holocaust Museum. I've published books on Nazi science and Nazi medicine. And so I was really tuned into this issue of, you know, the Holocaust and use of race. And I saw the tobacco industry playing this Nazi card, calling its critics, you know, tobacco Taliban or neo-Nazis and things like this. And so I really wanted to sort of to say, well, look, in what way are they a little bit like the Nazis? I mean, you know, when we talk about a Holocaust, we talk about a total burning. Or a total catastrophe.
The word means.
That's what the word means. And, you know, here's a case where we tolerate this enormous cause of death. Most people are apathetic. We just assume it's a normal part of life. And so I really wanted to turn the industry's rhetoric on itself and really speak the truth, you know, that this really is a catastrophe and we're doing too little to stop it.
And one of the interesting issues, but also sensitive, and I hate to give credit, but you have to give credit where credit is due, how the Third Reich really researched very thoroughly the effects of, you know, how cigarettes affected the human body. And I have to give them credit for that. And if people had listened to them, but because of their ideology, I guess that knowledge was shunned and it kind of packaged together like, okay, well, they're trying to destroy everybody. You know, trying to destroy the Jews. You know, this pure race. So whatever they say is garbage. But in actuality, their science was pretty solid.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I actually did a whole book
on that. In terms of cigarettes and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I did a whole book on that called The Nazi War on Cancer. And
right.
Look, it's things like, you know, the V2 engine leads to Wernher von Braun's rocketry, which, you know, leads to landing a man on the moon. So, you know, there's this fascinating complexity about history that things can have very, very bizarre origins. And that was one of the things that the Nazis were worried about was bodily purity. Of course, they're also racial fanatics in other directions as well. So that's one of the beauty about the things about being a historian. You're allowed to look at these complexities and you don't just throw it under the rug.
Now, some crazy things that came up in the book. Trucks being driven up into urban housing projects, passing out free cigarettes. Baboons smoking crack cocaine with tobacco in a research lab from a crack pipe. Talk to us a little bit about that. That was so, I was like, this man is killing me. My brain is going to explode.
I know. That section is called Texas Baboons on Crack.
Yes.
And it was bizarre because the world's largest baboonery is in the Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas. And they do a lot of secret military and tobacco research there. And they were addicting baboons to crack cocaine so they could test whether this particular delivery device could be abused or not. And, I mean, that's one of the other things I look briefly at, and I have some students looking at, is the history of animal abuse in the cigarette industry, because that's also something that's never been exposed.
Well, they spent a lot of money on research, and some of the things they were doing with the mice, you show some pictures in your book with the tumors on the ears and paste-like formulas being put on the backs of the mice to see the aphex. But one of the really interesting bestsellers is the actual government and the tobacco industry via taxes. Talk to the audience just briefly about that love-hate relationship, I guess.
Well, that's key. I call it the second addiction or double addiction because in the same way that smokers are addicted, governments throughout the world are addicted to tobacco taxes. And for many years, tobacco was a major form of revenue for government. So in 1950 in Britain, for example, cigarette taxes were 20% of the entire national revenue. In the late 19th century, tobacco tariffs were a third of the entire income for the United States government. In China, when I first started working on this, tobacco taxes were 12% of the entire Chinese state revenue. And so this creates a massive conflict of interest. You know, the government basically supports tobacco because they're getting all this money from it.
And let's be clear that this is not just limited to the United States. This is a global business that once they could not do certain things in America, they went out to, you know, Holland or other places you were mentioning, driving the buses, so to speak, through neighborhoods, giving out things. In other countries, you know, farmers get breaks for planting tobacco. But here, I believe you mentioned that they were banned or they're paid not to farm tobacco. Is that true? Did I read that?
The subsidies are finally dwindling and going away. There are still people who are getting paid not to grow tobacco, but this is an arcane system that's almost Byzantine in its complexity. It's kind of feudal, where people were paid or not paid. There were allotments of whether you could or couldn't grow tobacco. But it really just shows you how deeply tobacco penetrated our official policies. I mean, just one other example, the presidents since late 1930s have been required to issue an annual statement on cancer. It wasn't until 1977 that a president even mentioned that smoking might cause cancer. I mean, that's how, you know, distorted our politics have been.
And your book states, and you have lots of notes to verify, this is not just some, you know, this book is tirelessly researched. You can, if anybody is interested, I'll be giving away a free copy of the book. But anybody else who doesn't win, you need to check the book out, The Golden Holocaust, because he needed a vacation after writing this book. But now let's get to some of the solutions you talk about. And I had a question, or I kind of disagreed with one of the solutions. And one of them was putting the sale, I agree with banning completely. Totally. I don't see anything, you know, what for? Why do we need to have cigarettes? We didn't even get into the environmental issue of butts and everything, but that's another day. putting it in the hands of the state. I was kind of like, well, then, you know, won't the state become, you know, the devil, so to speak?
Yeah. No, I knew. There are basically two kinds of countries in the world, countries where the tobacco industry runs the state and countries where the state runs the tobacco industry. And it's not clear which is better. I mean, basically, we have a situation where the tobacco industry runs the government. In China, they've got one where the government runs the tobacco industry, and both are pretty much equally bad, I think.
Now, one of the things you talk about is putting more money into, helping people stop. And I don't think it's considered as, like, you know, you compare tobacco and alcohol, and you say that tobacco is worse. Why? Talk to the audience about that.
Well, they're really quite different. Only about 5% of people who drink alcohol are actually addicted or are alcoholics. But with smoking cigarettes, 80 or 90% of everyone who smokes is addicted. And that gives it a completely different ethical calculus, you might say. In other words, I also found this one great secret document from Canada where a very top guy in the Imperial Tobacco Company says smoking is not like drinking, it's like being an alcoholic. And what that means is you can use alcohol, I think, responsibly, and most people do, but you really can't smoke cigarettes responsibly. All use is abuse. And what that also means is that whereas, as I say, most people can drink responsibly, that's a possibility. With smoking, basically all smokers, almost all smokers want to quit. And so that's what actually first gave me the idea for abolition. Not prohibition, but abolition, since smoking really is a form of slavery. This notion that smokers themselves don't like the fact they smoke. Survey after survey shows that almost all smokers want to quit, they feel they can't or they have difficulty, and that's why I came to this notion of abolition.
Well, like I said, I totally agree with you. And there was a website I was trying to glance at. I've folded so many pages in your book, you'd probably be disgusted. I have so many little dog ears, so to speak, in there, little pieces of paper. But there was a website, it was a library website with a lot of documents from the tobacco industry. Do you remember that address, URL, off the top of your head? Could you give that to the audience?
Well, it's if you look up UCSF Legacy Tobacco Library, UCSF, as in University of California, San Francisco, Tobacco Library, and you'll get the online library, and it's 70 million pages of documents, and you can search it. You know, people plug, my students plug their names in, and they find their grandparents and this and that. There are 100,000 consumer letters in there. It's the biggest online business archive in the world, and it's the industry's secret documents, and it's basically unexplored. But anyone with an internet connection can search it.
And one of the interesting things, they tried to ban that or stop the use in 2012, but a judge extended it further so that it wouldn't stay up. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. The industry hates these documents. In fact, it kind of backfired. Their strategy originally when releasing them, this was before the internet, in litigation they would flood the lawyers with a whole rooms full of documents and basically thinking they could drown you out. It's called papering or dumping. And it backfired because eventually we got the right to put these on the internet and now they're full text searchable.
Well, I think that's wonderful, and I think your book is awesome. I hope that you write other books about other topics in such detail and passion. Let me just mention some of the solutions that you talk about. We talked about, banning completely. You talk about banning indoor public spaces, outdoor spaces where people congregate, because secondhand smoke is another horrible issue. I know I was in an apartment building, and the smoke would come up from downstairs. It could come down from upstairs into my apartment. I don't smoke anything. Talking about stopping all tobacco subsidies and supports, placing rated R ratings on films that depict smoking. Now, as a parent, I totally appreciate that because it starts young. The marketing of cigarettes starts young as elementary school age. One of the things you talk about is sharing with children graphically but creatively about, the problems with tobacco and smoking. Listen to smokers, people who smoke, like you said, don't want to smoke. It's not like a pleasurable thing, but they feel the need because of the addiction. That is a really key issue, and I think their voices have been silenced. Issues have been silenced. And there are people who say, my grandfather smoked for 90 years. He lived till, 97. What do you have to say about those kind of people?
Well, that's basically a tobacco strategy. The industry has celebrated those people for years. There's always a few exceptions, right? I mean, my granddad, he smoked and then he quit, and as a result lived a long life, but he had smoked. There's always exceptions. It's a statistical phenomenon. It doesn't kill you right away. That's part of the diabolical nature of it. It kills you much later. So, that's important.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on the show. I just finished speaking with Robert Proctor, Golden Holocaust. I'll be giving away a copy of your book, so you guys want to follow me at Joy Keys or become a fan on Facebook, look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. And will you be doing any reading or going anywhere to talk about the book anytime soon?
Well, I don't really have those things planned. I'm trying to do a couple of these radio shows with you, but I don't really have readings planned.
Okay, well, people need to read the book. You need to go and online and order the book, Golden Holocaust. But, again, I'll be giving away a copy. Thank you so much for writing this book and sharing your knowledge and, all the hours that I know you spent researching. Thank you for doing that. You have a great day, okay?
You too, Joy. It's great to be on your show.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Again, I'll be giving away a copy of Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition by Robert N. Proctor. A must read, a must read. You must share with your friends and family. It's just absolutely amazing. I think your brain might explode. But thank you so much for tuning in. You guys have a wonderful Saturday. And again, follow @JoyKeys and become a fan on Facebook.